Well, he's right. Every word, especially the word killer, because my speech, I hope, will commit some homicide, but I think in this audience it might deserve the verdict of justifiable homicide, and I hope to document what I say. The title of my speech is Breathing the Haunted Air, or How Eurocommunism Came to the United States. Several years ago at an Eastern university, a rather remarkable event occurred. A group of faculty members had painted on the office door of one of their number the following legend, Institute for Marxist Studies. In a little cardboard box outside the office door were mimeographed handouts listing courses and teachers at this new institute. Some faculty members were listed on the handout as teaching courses based on or dealing with Marxism as part of the curriculum. What they had now done was to put together all the courses, either on Marxism or based on Marxist thought, given in various departments, history, political science, sociology, economics, and unilaterally established a so-called institute, prepared their own special catalog of courses, which by their decision have now become a two-year sequence. Seeing the new sign on the office door, several faculty members inquired whether the creation of the Institute had been approved as it should have been by the Faculty Senate. It turned out the Senate knew nothing about the Institute. Upon further inquiry, it turned out that the administration knew about the Institute, but had neither approved nor disapproved, since the faculty members involved had not formally asked for permission. Was the administration then prepared to dissolve the so-called Institute and order the name removed from the office? No. Why not? What the hell was the response? They were teaching these Marxist courses anyway, so what difference did it make if they put all the courses together and called it an institute at this taxpayer-supported public university? Well, supposing they had called it the Institute for Marxist-Leninist Studies, would the administration have done anything about it? Tough question, but hypothesis contrary to fact. Could you have an institute of anti-Marxist studies? No, because nobody was teaching such courses. Hypothesis contrary to fact. In other words, while there is no such subject as anti-Marxism, there is today something called Marxism, and therefore there can be an institute. Hypothesis not contrary to fact. Thus, by an academic coup d'etat, a group of professors, most of them Marxists, at a taxpayer-funded university, established an Institute of Marxist Studies, which has become an official part of the university curriculum. A second case history. Recently, I came across a book published by Columbia University Press, a collection of essays edited by a political scientist titled Administrative Secrecy in Developed Countries. The book is a comparative study of administrative secrecy, the book is sponsored by the International Institute for Administrative Sciences. And there are essays by experts from Finland, the Scandinavian countries, the U.S., Belgium, France, West Germany, Britain, and Canada. Also included in this comparative study of secrecy are Hungary and Yugoslavia. The essays being written by local political scientists, not exiles, living within their respective communist dictatorships. Now, it is inconceivable that a political scientist from South Africa or Chile would be allowed to contribute a stirring defense of his country's administrative secrecy practices in the guise of political analysis. Now, these East European political scientists, what they wrote is totally irrelevant to the true situation in Yugoslavia and Hungary. But the editor of the symposium treated their contributions with the same seriousness as he did the contributions from the Western democracies. Worse, while his introductory essay is a useful critical analysis of the essays contributed by the Western political scientists, he offered no analysis at all of what the East Europeans had written. The articles by the three East Europeans were pure propaganda. For example, the one on Hungary says that the parliament and the presidium, quote, are made up of representatives chosen by universal and secret suffrage. They forgot to mention that the election results are usually 99.2% for, 0.7% against, and 0.1% spoiled ballots. The article also says that, quote, scholars are guaranteed freedom of research by a constitutional provision, unquote. In Hungary, the article by a Yugoslav political scientist opens with this marvelous sentence, quote, the development of democracy in every modern society depends on the openness of its institutions, unquote. Well, what the hell? In March 1978, Jimmy Carter, during the White House dinner in honor of Marshal Tito, described the Yugoslav dictator, and I quote, a hero of freedom. At a time when there were more political prisoners in communist Yugoslavia, according to Mihailo Mihailov, one of Tito's victims, there were more political prisoners in communist Yugoslavia than there had been in the pre-war days of the monarchy. Now, the scandalous aspect of this book comes when the editor sets out two categories of 12 countries examined in this study. 7 have laws providing for a public right to secret information, and 5 lack such an entrenched right. The first category includes the Scandinavian countries, Finland, the U.S., and Hungary and Yugoslavia. The countries without such an entrenched right are reactionary backward regimes like Belgium, Britain, Canada, France, and West Germany. Let me recall another and last example of the miasm which envelops the American university and the power which has been achieved by a bedraggled, decayed, anti-humanist belief system which goes by the name of Marxism. In August 1979, the International Political Science Association met in Moscow. Now, the fact is that there were people in the Soviet Union who were called political scientists, and therefore, their organization is a fully accredited member of the IPSA. But everybody knows there are no political scientists in the Soviet Union any more than there are historians, sociologists, or social scientists generally. Why should IPSA not only accept the Soviet Association into membership, but even agree to hold an international conference in a country whose very existence violates every rule of academic freedom and free inquiry? Would IPSA hold a meeting in Johannesburg or Santiago de Chile? Perhaps the next IPSA meeting might be held in Warsaw, and the noted sociologist, General Jaruzelski, could open the program. Now, I could go on, as you know, ad nauseam with countless examples and similar case histories. They would all point to a strange paradox. Why is it that despite the awfulness of Soviet communism, Mao communism, Vietnamese and Cambodian communism, North Korean and Cuban communism, the uprisings in Eastern Europe, the genocides in Southeast Asia, the economic failures of communist countries, and on, why don't any or all of these horrors and atrocities seem to matter to Marxists? The hardcore variety, or to put it in the French style, Marxisant, the fellow travelers of Marxism. Full faith and credit is always given to the Marxist left, whether in Nicaragua, El Salvador, or wherever a communist-supported Marxist guerrilla movement is trying to shoot its way to power. With each Soviet or communist aggression, whether Afghanistan or Poland, anti-Americanism grows. The parades, the mass meetings, the resolutions demand Western unilateral disarmament, but Soviet military powers explain the way. The people who lead these parades and protests, whether for doing nothing about Poland or for doing everything about unilateral disarmament, don't all seem to boast Communist Party credentials. It may even be that there are far fewer pro-Moscow communists in the West than ever before, far fewer followers of the Communist Party line than ever before. There aren't many fellow travelers of the Beatrice and Sidney Webb 1930s variety, although David Rockefeller, Donald Kendall, and Citibank executives are vying for that distinction. nobody goes around making crude culinary statements like you can't make omelets without breaking eggs. Yet the Soviet peace and propaganda line was never stronger. By and large, we know communism is dead, finished, repudiated by everybody, including the Soviet worker. Communism is repudiated by workers in the Western democracies and in Japan, and in most cases by their trade unions. Communism is obviously rejected in Eastern Europe by millions of people who, when given the chance to get out of a communist country, grab it. Yet there is some kind of an ideological message which has power and influence over Western intellectuals. How can this be? I have a working hypothesis as to why in 1980 Moscow was stronger politically than ever before in its history, except during the period in World War II when Stalin was forced to fight his former ally, Adolf Hitler. And I put before you two simple propositions. One, Marxism is the communism of the 1980s. And two, Marxism is the American version of Eurocommunism. Marxism and Marx-mongering is the growth industry in two American institutions, the universities and the churches. And it may not even be the Marxism expounded by Karl Marx or Friedrich Engels, although that might be bad enough. It's just Marxism, or the action taken in the name of Marxism, or a derivative of Marxism. Economic disasters, which in a capitalist country would be described as disasters, become humanist achievements when they occur in a self-proclaimed paradise like Tanzania. In fact, in any country which can boast that it is a Marxist People's Republic, the problem of human rights disappears among those Western humanitarians who visit Havana to discuss the awful plight of the peasants in El Salvador and the rigged elections in the tragic country of El Salvador with a Fidel Castro who is yet to hold one. How can this be? The power of something called Marxism, the power of ideas and ideology over politics and culture, the impact of ideas in history and culture. Such considerations are too often overlooked and forgotten, particularly by the people in the White House today. Lionel Trilling once wrote, quote, "Ideology is not ideas. Ideology is not acquired by thought, but by breathing the haunted air." The haunted air. According to Isaiah Berlin, it was Alexander Herzen, the Russian philosopher and publicist, who created, as he says, almost single-handedly, the tradition and the ideology of systematic revolutionary agitation, and thereby founded the revolutionary movement in Russia. Chapman Pincher, in his important book, Their Traitor's Treachery, describes how in the early 1930s, Marxism became the rage among Cambridge intellectuals, and how it led men like Guy Burgess and Anthony Blunt and who knows how many others to treason on behalf of Stalin. And here is John Kenneth Galbraith's boast in 1957, and I quote him, "It was the universities which led the opposition to the Vietnam War, which forced the retirement of President Johnson, which are leading the battle against the great corporations on the issue of pollution, and which at the last congressional elections retired a score or more of the most egregious time servers, military sycophants, and hawks." And as an extra little touch about Galbraith, last year as he stood before the Berlin Wall, he said, and I quote, "I am not particular about freedom. I think the wall is a good thing. At least it has maintained the peace." And I thought of the words of Tacitus, "They make a wilderness and call it peace." Shortly after the Reagan election, Chronicles of Culture, one of my favorite magazines, wrote a most perceptive essay on the meaning of that election. "The Republican landslide," said the magazine, "the Republican landslide of 1980 was a victorious battle, but it was only a political triumph. The cultural war for the American soul is still going on. The politically defeated side is in command of awesome weapons. It still rules the media, higher education, the entertainment industry." And as I will point out later in the speech, it still rules the government media, specifically the Voice of America. What Chronicles of Culture was saying was something William Barrett pointed out recently. Americans cannot grasp the passion of an idea or its malignancy. Professor Lewis Foyer, in his important study, Marx and the Intellectuals, has discussed the enormous power of American intellectuals during the 1930 Depression. And he writes, and I quote Professor Foyer, "The whole conception of a social experiment, the whole notion of planned human intervention into social processes to raise the welfare of the people have become linked in the minds of America's intellectual and social leaders with the practice of the Soviet Union. This transformation of American thought was largely the work of a small number of several hundreds of travelers to the Soviet Union during the previous decade, namely the 1920s. And, says Professor Foyer, if there was no Tocqueville among them, the reports that they published affected the American political consciousness more deeply, nonetheless, than any other foreign influence in its history." And let me point out that this was a time when the media, meaning for the most part the press and periodicals, was little influenced by the left, by the communists, and by left liberals, except, of course, for Walter Duranty of the New York Times, in Moscow, The Nation, and The New Republic, and others. The Soviet Union, due to the influence of several hundred intellectuals, became what Lewis Foyer called the conscience model for America. Among what today we would call the agents of influence who peddled the Soviet conscience model were distinguished men, many of whom later became anti-communists, men like Professors John Dewey, Rexford Tugwell, Paul Douglas, William Kilpatrick, George Counts. A good many of these men later turned against Soviet communism. Perhaps this is why Lionel Trilling wrote, "This is the great vice of academicism, that it is concerned with ideas rather than with thinking. And nowadays, the errors of academicism do not stay in the academy. They make their way into the world. And what begins as a failure of perception among intellectual specialists finds its fulfillment in policy and action." Marxism today has enormous power and influence over mainstream intellectuals because it makes it possible for them to be ritualistically anti-Soviet and pro-communist left at the same time. The 12th century freethinker Averroes invented the doctrine of double truth, that is, the peaceful coexistence of two independent and contradictory truths, the one philosophical, the other religious, so that when the USSR does something terrible, the Marxists can announce a solidarity with the Polish working class, but then in his pro-communist persona warn against using Poland as an excuse for NATO intervention and then go on to demand NATO disarmament. Today's Marxists are the Euro-communists of America. They claim when pressed by that the Soviet Union is not socialist. This is what they claim. If they're pressed quite hard, that they say it's not even Marxist, although the Soviet Union claims to be a true follower of Marx and Lenin. You would then think that these Marxist hierophants would be bitter at this misappropriation of a sacred name, at this betrayal of mankind's best hopes, at the purges, the executions, the genocides, that they would be anti-Soviet to the extent that they would consistently not only condemn the Soviet regime, but press for Western armament, not disarmament. Never. Now, many of these intellectuals learned to their sorrow, some soon and some late, what Soviet communism meant, what Marxism meant, but there seems to be always a new generation prepared to ignore the past and eager to be seduced. In his essay on Lord Palmerston, Karl Marx opened with a reference to Ariosto's romance poem called Orlando Furioso. Describing a hero in one of Ariosto's cantos, Marx wrote in 1853, Ruggiero was again and again fascinated by the false charms of Alcine, which he knows to disguise an old witch. Sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. And the knight errant cannot help falling in love with her anew, whom he knows to have transmuted all her former lovers into asses and other beasts. The English public, writes Marx, is another Ruggiero, and Palmerston another Alcine. All one needs, of course, to make Marx's literary illusion contemporary is to substitute Marxism for Alcine the witch and for the foolish Ruggiero, the latter-day Marxist social scientists who populate American universities and the theological faculties of our seminaries. And it is with these Ruggieros I now want to deal. In our universities and seminaries, an ideology has become a social science to several thousand, if not many more, social scientists and theologians who openly call themselves Marxists or sympathizers, and whom earlier I referred to also as Marxism. Even Westless ideology, posing as truth and science, is being taught not as intellectual history or the history of ideas, all of which would be proper, and no different from teaching Machiavelli or Hume. It is being taught as a moral code, and I will prove this later, an incontrovertible analysis of democracy, of capitalism, and its inevitable successor, Marxist socialism. Marxist dogmas today are regarded as respectable, even by those teachers who may not be committed Marxists. Many of the teachers who deal with Marxism in our universities believe in its doctrines, even though their application has been pernicious, and they seek to influence and even organize students as Marxists and to peddle Marxism as a total philosophy of existence. Marxism has turned out to be a false intellectual construct, a spurious philosophical system. Marxist analysis has been unable to explain Nazism, Stalinism, the origins of World War II, the productive successes of capitalism, and above all, the dismal failures of Marxism itself. To be a Marxist today is to have announced one's withdrawal from the democratic consensus. Today's Marxists claim to be the party of humanity, and while seeming to be unorganized, they have established a power base within the American university. Professor Bernard Brown of the City University in New York has described these Marxist revolutionary intellectuals, and I quote, as especially dangerous because they have taken positions of power within the universities from which they will be able to extend their ideas. William Barrett has described Marxism as, quote, the most powerful ideology of the modern age, while Professor Klaus Koenig has called socialism, and I quote, the most powerful subculture of our time. The most visibly important Marxist transmission belt in the United States today is the Institute for Policy and Studies, the so-called think tank of the left. According to a New York Times article, the IPS annual report said that its European branch, quote, almost completely comes out of a Marxist or at least a liberation basis. The IPS director said that while the American and Soviet, I'm quoting, the American and Soviet systems lead to dead ends, the Soviet failure has produced, and I quote, a whole range of interesting social experiments, including Yugoslavia, Hungary, Poland, Cuba, and Nicaragua. Now, if the IPS announced that it was pro-communist or pro-Soviet, which it is, it couldn't get away with it. But if it's Marxist or liberationist, that's okay. Nobody here but just us successful social experiments. But there's more to IPS. Its camouflage is so successful that 52 members of Congress, all Democrats, except Hamilton Fish Jr., a Republican, have asked IPS, this is from the Washington Post of February 19th, have asked IPS to finance a wide-ranging series of studies ranging from defense to housing. Prospective authors for these studies include Professor Bertrand Gross, the author of Friendly Fascism, and Professor Francis Fox Piven of Boston University, a Marxist and a vice president of the American Political Science Association. She recently told the U.S. News and World Report, I quote, "There is a growing acceptance of the critical approach taken by Marxists and other radical leftists as a useful means of advancing our knowledge of society and its problems," unquote. Marxism and Marxists have benefited from six dispensations granted to them by the culture and the politics of our time. First, for Marxism, the jury is always out. It never returns a verdict, and so it never makes a mistake. Marxism's partners, Moscow, Peking, Havana, and all the others, are always defined out of existence by Marxists who never suspend judgment on democracy. Unlike Marxism, democracy is to be repudiated because of its two visible faults. For example, Frank Barnett, co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies and holder of the chair of the op-ed page of the New York Times, says that the U.S. is suffering from, quote, "a decline in official respect for human rights," while, quote, "ironically, one area of the world that can point to some improvement is the Soviet Union." Marxism benefits from a second dispensation. Marxism never has any crises. Communism has crises. The USSR has crises, but not communism. Thus, Marxism as part of reality is never involved with reality. The third dispensation of Marxism is the homegrown fallacy. For example, the New York Times op-ed recently had a column by one Philip Berryman, Central American representative of the American Friends Service Committee. This is just a few weeks ago. The question he asked, should the U.S. negotiate with the El Salvador Marxists? Yes, the guerrillas are Marxist in orientation, quote, but their Marxism is homegrown, unquote, which decoded means, according to the culture, they're okay, not communists, not Soviet fool men, just Marxists, homegrown like corn. In other words, Marxism tied to Moscow creates problems, unless, of course, it's Cuban Marxism, and then that's a fact of life which the U.S. forced upon Cuba. Marxism benefits from a fourth dispensation. You don't even have to utter the word Marxism. You never even have to read a line of Marx or quote him. You just describe Marxist ideas as your own. For example, Bishop Dale Wright of the United Methodist Church recently said, "All of us really are hostages, those in the developed countries as well as in developing nations. We are hostages to a vast political economic system of cruelty structures which are preordaining that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer." In case you didn't realize it, he's talking about American capitalism. Anyway, it isn't true. The number of persons with incomes below the conventional poverty line is now 5% compared with about 40% in 1929. So much for Marx's prophecy about the inevitable pauperization of the working class under capitalism. Marxism's fifth dispensation is the objective truth fallacy. We have been looking at the study of Marxism as a respectable academic discipline and treating it as such. Merely to call it Marxist studies is to give it the same respectability as calling it physics or sociology. But Marxist studies, despite our indifference, is not a neutral term like political science or anthropology. It is perfectly acceptable to teach Marx as one teaches Hegel or William James, but Marxism, by Marx's own dictate, must be an action philosophy, a praxis. Marx proposed not only to explain the world, as the philosopher he claimed to be, but like the revolutionary he was, he proposed to change it. Marxism's sixth dispensation is the assumption granted that it is a science, not merely a theory of society, but a science of society. Yet, while its votaries like Marx and Engels before them wear the gown of exploratory research scientists, they resist scientific examination of their science, arguing that its immutable laws are such as to be untestable and immune to a theory of falsification. Marxism, if it is anything, is a determinist's model, something incompatible with both democracy and experience. It is a spurious metaphysics which by definition is not empirically verifiable. It propagates doctrines about historical inevitability as a way of making unpalatable truths palatable because they are inevitable. Now, true science, as opposed to metaphysical politics, depends for its acceptance on reason and even common sense, observations, experience. But in a Marxist state, reason is treason. Experience is constantly denied because it threatens the validity of Marxism. And Marxism, therefore, precludes a moral commitment to truth or to truth-seeking. The scientific socialism of Marx is really not scientific at all, but nothing more than disguised value judgments. And so today, to be a Marxist is to be anti-scientific, anti-reason, and to be a victim, a willing victim, of a built-in amnesia. Now, the value of Marxism as an ingenious substitute for Euro-communism, which after all demands a large communist party, is that Marxism alone justifies anti-Americanism. Professor Sidney Hook recently wrote that the disillusioned fellow traveling American intellectuals have bequeathed anti-Americanism rather than pro-communism to the contemporary generation of disaffected intellectuals. This anti-Americanism, said Hook, is manifest on every issue in which there is a conflict between the Soviet Union or one of its proxies and American national interests. I would broaden Professor Hook's comments and argue that today there couldn't be an ideological anti-American communism without Marxism. Anti-Americanism without Marxism has no meaning such as it might have had in the days of Henry James. How else could one justify anti-Americanism, including treason and the denigration of patriotism, without some intellectual apologia? Marxism supplies the rationale for anti-Americanism. Anti-Americanism and Marxism go hand in hand and make possible the built-in amnesia about the socialist states, make it possible for a Marxist to agree with Jean-Paul Sartre when he said, "To keep hope alive, one must, in spite of all mistakes, horrors, and crimes, recognize the obvious superiority of the socialist camp." Norman Perhoretz wrote in his fine book, Breaking Ranks, that America's left-wing intellectuals have decreed for themselves, and I quote, "loyalty to radicalism as against loyalty to intellectual standards." Again, I would amplify Perhoretz's sentence by arguing that it is more than loyalty to radicalism or loyalty to socialism. It is an unyielding loyalty to Marxism. Radicalism in America hasn't paid off. Socialism is a visible disaster. Marxist states are a problem to argue about intellectually. So Marxism, qua Marxism, becomes the strategy, the way out. By day, you can be a scholar explaining the world. By night, you can be a revolutionary, a Marxist revolutionary, seeking to change the world. Radicalism today means Marxism, and by extrapolation, Leninism. What else could it mean? Christian radicalism? We must re-examine such concepts as anti-communism because few people, as Sidney Hook has said, are pro-communist. And despite attempts by writers like Vivian Gornick to re-gild the communists, there aren't many CP members today. That is why I say Marxism is the communism of the 1980s. The Marxmongers in the universities and the churches have extrapolated their Marxism into an anti-democratic, anti-Americanism, which poses as anti-capitalism. I haven't given much attention to the Marxification of the American churches because of the time problem, but I would like to share with you an exclusive, as it's called in journalism, thanks to Michael Scully, editor of This World, a new magazine, sponsored by the Institute for Educational Affairs. Now, I'd also like to recommend to you, it's outside, Raoul Isaac's book on the churches called Sanctifying Revolution, Mainline Churchmen Turn Radical. It's a publication of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and you'll find copies outside. The Michael Scully told me they've got a survey which will be out in June. It's made by the Roper Center at the University of Connecticut, which will shock even hardened anti-communists like us. and anti-Marxist. And I can only give you a brief summary, three findings. Over half the theology faculty of many mainline religious denominations believe that Marxism is compatible with membership in a religious denomination. Over half. If you ever wanted a graphic example of cognitive dissonance, the absence of consistency between knowledge, ideas, and beliefs, it is to see no inconsistency between Marxism and religious belief. The second question presented this sentence to the respondents. Do you agree or disagree? In the United States today, there can be no justification for using violence to achieve political goals. One-fifth of the theological faculties from non-liturgical denominations, that is Methodist, Baptist, or Presbyterian, under 45 years of age, one-fifth disagreed with that statement. That is, they believe there is justification in the U.S. today for using violence to achieve political goals. The third question was on a continuum of 1 to 10, where the theological faculties could score the United States in terms of the responsiveness of government to popular wishes. If you circled 1, that's the best possible situation. That is, the government is responsive to popular wishes. To circle the number 10 meant that the government is totally unresponsive to popular wishes. 3/4 of the respondents from the liturgical denominations, that is 75% under 45, answered by circling anywhere from 6 to 10. 7% actually circled 10, which in this survey, unlike Bo Derek in the movie 10, meant the worst, not the best. Now, for me, the most startling penetration of the Marxist ethos is to be found in the recent broadcast of The Voice of America. Since I do not live in the United States, I listen fairly regularly to VOA news programs. Let me tell you what foreign listeners have been hearing over VOA since President Reagan took office. February 1981, VOA broadcast an interview on El Salvador policy with the head of the Johns Hopkins Latin American Studies Department. The good professor, naturally enough, denounced U.S. policy. The other side of the question was not presented. March 1981. Had you been listening to VOA, you would have thought that the official U.S. spokesman on El Salvador was former Ambassador Robert White. He had testified before a congressional committee and made harsh criticisms of the Reagan policy. Was in the form of a VOA commentary, pallid, defensive, pathetic. No wonder a British friend recently suggested that America's standing abroad would be immeasurably enhanced if VOA were abolished. March 1981. This is a beaut. There's a program reminder that after the news, there will be an interview with Professor Tom Anderson, Eastern Connecticut State College. VOA says he has written a recently published book about a massacre in El Salvador. I listen horrified. Oh, no, a massacre. I can hardly wait. The news is over, now the interview. It was a massacre which had occurred in 1932, a half a century ago. How timely. Just a little historical background to the current story. This being the 40th anniversary of the Katyn massacre, I'm waiting for VOA to give me some historical background on Polish events. Well, you can't blame Reagan. He's only been president for a mere 41 days. Give him a chance. The same day, there is a report about the administration attempt to repeal the Clark Amendment and Angola. VOA says that, quote, some people, unquote, unnamed, suggest that if the U.S. helps Savimbi, the U.S. will be doing just what the Russians are doing, engaging in wars of national liberation. Tut, tut. It's like Sartre's 1950 metaphysics. How can we condemn slave labor in the USSR when we have outhouses and pellagra in the South? September 30th, 1981, 253 days into the Reagan administration. VOA was unbelievable that night. The Defense Department earlier that day had published its outstanding graphic report on Soviet armaments. The VOA report carried a three-minute, if that, segment of an ABC interview with Caspar Weinberger. He was followed by a former CIA executive, Herbert Scoville, for about 8 minutes. Scoville chopped Weinberger and the Defense Department report into an unrecognizable pulp. Scoville's analysis left me with the conclusion that the USSR was really weak, that the Defense Department is exaggerating Soviet arms superiority for its own mysterious purpose, which means, of course, the purposes are not mysterious at all. Were I a foreigner listening to Weinberger and Scoville, I'd believe Scoville. November 18, 1981, more than 300 days into the Reagan administration, the newsreader begins by talking about, quote, a debate which took place today in Moscow at the Supreme Soviet, the Soviet Union's parliament. Could I be listening to Radio Moscow? No, it was VOA which said that the debate concerned the five-year plan. Now, those of us who are not at VOA know that there are no debates in the Supreme Soviet unless they are prearranged. If there were a debate at the Supreme Soviet, the last one took place in 1918, that would be news. The voice of the U.S. government says there is a parliament and debates in the Soviet Union, and by calling the Supreme Soviet a parliament, it equates it with Westminster in Britain and the American Congress. Same broadcast, after a short summary of President Reagan's nuclear disarmament proposal, a few minutes of his recorded speech, VOA puts on Mary Calder, who demolished the Reagan speech. At least that was what she tried to do with NBC's Tom Brokaw, which VOA picked up. But couldn't VOA find a non-government person who agreed with Reagan and present both sides? Were I a foreign listener, the Calder commentary would have convinced me that Reagan's speech was drivel. I want to conclude with one more example of the kind of VOA reporting that's been going on and may still be going on under even the new dispensation. It is March 1st this year, 14 months into the Reagan administration. This night there is an attack on the administration's Taiwan policy. As usual, when there is something anti-Reagan, anti-administration, pro-Marxist regimes in Central Africa, it is National Public Radio, or NPR, which a nasty friend of mine calls NBR for National Bolshevik Radio, which does the reporting. For an analysis of NPR programming called All Things Considered, see, if you will, Aram Bakshian's article in the Washington Journalism Review for last October. NPR's director, Frank Mankiewicz, as you know, worked for Robert Kennedy and for George McGovern. And keep in mind that NPR's access to VOA is a VOA decision. So you have this interview against Reagan's Taiwan policy. And guess who is doing the talking? Who the interviewee is? Professor John K. Fairbank, a Harvard scholar with such tainted credentials as an observer of Chinese affairs that a Washington Post reviewer on February 14th in the Washington Post attacked Fairbank's latest book, his memoirs called China Bound, in these words, and I'm quoting from the Washington Post, "Why did John King Fairbank, the gifted scholar and the zealous champion of the liberal education tradition, fail to resolutely condemn the persecution, often to death, of his colleagues, acquaintances, and friends in China, both before and during the Cultural Revolutions?" The reviewer couldn't possibly be accused of McCarthyism. He was the Peking correspondent for the Toronto Globe and Mail between 1977 and 1979. The reviewer John Fraser called Fairbank a propagandist, a man guilty of reckless self-deception, one who wears historically objective blinkers, who lectured the long-suffering Chinese on their good fortune under communism. John King Fairbank. Now, I don't expect better from NPR. I have a right to expect better from VOA. I'm not even saying that Fairbank's view should be barred from VOA. But isn't it incumbent on VOA to get another viewpoint, or at least to let the audience know Fairbank's reputation as a China watcher, I don't want the other viewpoint to be the Taiwan desk officer in the State Department, but there are plenty of scholars with untainted credentials who could be interviewed. Why should VOA be a willing prisoner of NPR's assignment sheet? When one sees the administration's inability to deal with the Voice of America, one begins to wonder who is President of the United States. And let me also, in passing, ask why the Defense Department doesn't listen to its own network, the American Forces Radio and Television Network, and discover why who is running NPR interviews of pacifist anti-nuclear propaganda to our men in the armed forces. What I've just described to you about VOA is for me confirmation of my belief that the Marxist ethos is more pervasive among the professional classes and the American government than I had thought. I do not listen to all VOA broadcasts, but I listen at least three or four times a week, and I have yet to hear a conservative, neoconservative, anti-Marxist view or interview on the overseas broadcast. Of course, I only hear the English broadcasts. What is said in other languages, I do not know. Does Charlie Wick know? Do any of the executives, are they listening? And I would recommend to you, by the way, a superb article on VOA in the current Harper's, it's out now, by Tom Bethel, whom you will meet tonight. He's got even worse documentation than I've had. I now want to comment very quickly about the entrance of open and avowed Marxists on American faculties, a phenomenon already described in a number of publications. The faculty Marxists remind me of a creature called the Inquiline. There are two definitions of the Inquiline. Webster defines it as an animal, usually an insect, that lives in the nest or the abode of another animal, with or without harm to the host. The OED defines an equiline as one of an order of insects, usually beetles, found in ants' nests, which the ants never molest but even take great care of. This is going to be my metaphor of the day, the Marxist equiline, residing in the university nest, which never harms the host, it seems, and yet is never molested. Business Week reported that there is no precise measure of Marxist influence on American campuses, but said Business Week it has clearly grown enormously over the past decade. There are something like at least 10,000 members with more than a dozen Marxist journals in print in different radical campus caucuses. And in the history profession, it's particularly noticeable. U.S. News and World Report earlier this year in January said there were clusters of radical scholars at the University of Massachusetts, Boston University, Rutgers, Stanford, Chicago, NYU, and American University. And they gave the number. And there's also been some other articles on this. And I would recommend to you, if you want to know how far we've strayed from decent academic standards, read an article republished recently in Contentions, the publication of the Committee for the Free World, about a Professor Bruce Franklin and how he teaches Vietnam today at Rutgers University. There are many articles on this, and what I say is what we've created in America, what we are creating, is a creation of a social class and intelligentsia, very much like in Tsarist Russia, which will be devoted to the task of overthrowing the existing order. But our intelligentsia is far better off than the counterparts in Tsarist Russia. The publications are open. As Marx said, communists disdain to conceal their aims. So the Marxists at the American universities are moving in a direction where Marxism has become one of the most important courses given in the social sciences in American universities. Now, this is the last page. Being a Marxist doesn't necessarily mean that you're a communist or even pro-Soviet, but it does mean you're anti-American. not because you don't like America, but because Marxism dictates an end to the bourgeoisie and there are no constitutional amendments to the basic doctrines of Marxism. Our job is to take away the enormous prestige which Marxism enjoys in the academy, the churches, and even the media. We must deprive Marxism of its growing legitimacy as a course of study all its own. We must produce magazines of high scholarship with articles by anti-Marxists like Kenneth Minogue, Morris Cranston, Lesser Kolakowski, Feuer, Irving Kristol, Robert Conquest, analyzing and replying to the content of Marxist publications in this country. In other words, we must recognize that we have a Euro-communist problem which goes by the name of Marxism right here at home, and recognize that Marxism is the communism of the 1980s, the Euro-communist transplant, and we must recognize that Marxism in America is committed to the overthrow of capitalist democracy by whatever means suits the Marx mongers. I would say that this is a job which ought to be undertaken rather quickly before our universities become so totally politicized and Marxified that it will become too late to do anything about it. Thank you.